If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Tuesday, October the 30th, and welcome to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, the Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Fellow in Journalism here at the Hoover Institution. My guests today here on the campus of Stanford University are David Brady, Mo Fiorina, and Doug Rivers. All are Hoover Institution Senior Fellows. All are Stanford University political scientists. Collectively, they are three of the brightest minds I know when it comes to elections and political trends, and that's what we're talking about today, the election and the political trends surrounding it. Mo, we're going to start with you. Turn it into a Pick on Mo podcast, but Doug has got polling information, Dave's got observations, but Mo, you just wrote a piece in which you talked about polarization. This has been your hobby horse for several cycles now, polarization, and here we sit a week out of the election, and all we hear is this is the most polarized electorate in modern times, and Donald Trump polarizes matters, and Donald Trump polarizes matters, and Democrats polarize matters, and the horde of immigrants coming out from Central America polarize matters, and the shooting in Pennsylvania polarized matters, and the shooting in Florida polarizes matters. Polarize, 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 and you like to push back and say what?
I like to say that there's a misconception in that clearly our politics is more divided than it's been in a long time, but polarization is not what we're talking about here. Polarization in common parlance means the middle goes away, and that's not what's happened in American politics. The middle is still there. It's as big as ever. We have the support for a third party is at an all-time high. Proportion of people say they're moderates is at over 40%. What's happened in the United States, I've been arguing for more than 15 years now, is what we call sorting. That we used to have two big tent parties, Republicans and Democrats, were heterogeneous. There were conservative Democrats, there were liberal Republicans. Now we have two clearly ideologically defined parties. So if you want to talk about partisan polarization, that's fine. We have that. But we shouldn't forget when we use that term that 40% of the people going to have any partisanship at all. As a matter of fact, the proportion of partisans is at an all-time low. In the Eisenhower era, 75% of the American public said, I'm a Republican or a Democrat. Today that figure is at 60. It stood at about 60 in the last 10 years. Right. So we have more and more people declining to identify with either party as the two parties become more ideologically homogeneous.
So your most recent book is titled Unstable Majorities, Polarization, Party Sorting, and Political Stalemate. Apply that, please, to this midterm election.
I think we may very well have another instance of instability. What we've had since the early 90s, since 94 actually, is what I call unstable majorities, that basically no party can grab a hold of government and hold it for very long. Right. So the presidency switches hands, control of the House switches hands, control of the Senate switches hands. That's historically very unusual. You have to go back to the late 19th century to find a period like this. And I attribute it in part to the homogeneity of the parties, that basically each party has about a third of the electorate. You have to win the independents to win the election. So you win, and then you govern as your base wants, and the result is you lose support in the next election. So I would not be at all surprised after 2016. I was not at all surprised to predict that probably the Democrats will gain at least the House in the next election. And at the moment, that appears likely. At least that's, I think, what Doug has been telling me.
Right. So Dave Brady, you and Mo contributed to a book back in 2000 called Continuity and Change in House Elections.
I'm really impressed that someone reads their books.
I do my homework here. So this is the book you guys put out in 2000. This is after the rip-roaring 1990s that saw the Republicans come back to power for the first time in 40 years, and then saw this odd election in 1998 where Bill Clinton actually picked up seats in the House. And this seemed volatile at the time, but boy, that seems like small potatoes compared to what's going on this decade where, let's see, the House flips in 2010, the Senate flips in 2014. The House may flip back in 2018, and I don't know, Doug, if you've already looked ahead to the Senate elections in 2020. It's not a pretty landscape for Republicans who have to hold something like 22 seats to 11 for the Democrats, and there are a lot of Republicans in their 70s and 80s, so it could flip yet again. So
take that book
and let's put that in
that
the modern context.
That book was should be prepared by there was a conference we held at Hoover. And I think there are at least two papers out of that that were ahead of their time. The first was the notion that elections were becoming more national. prior to that time period, everybody, politics was local in the Tip O'Neill sense, and so what was happening was there was a huge incumbent advantage. Incumbents got the nomination. They won. Incumbents had about a 6 to 8 point advantage just going into the election. And the nationalization of elections, that which we identified a couple of papers, I think Mo was on that one, identified nationalization increasing. It's continued to increase, and the result has been is the individual advantage to incumbents has disappeared, gone from its high of 8 or 9 points down to around 2. Right. And the second paper was a paper Brandis Keynes Roan and John Cogan and I did on out of step, out of office. And that step, that paper showed that you could, if who lost in 64 and who lost elections were congressmen and congresswomen who were out of step with their district. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that what happened with the 1994 election, we didn't fully know at the time, was that you got rid of senators like Sasser and Democrats that were too liberal for their district, but too conservative for the party. Those went away, and Republicans that were on the other side that were too conservative, and so on, you got the flip on that. So those two articles were pretty early picked up on those things, and that's both those trends have continued over time to where we have the political situation today where very little incumbent advantage. And elections are closer now between Democrats and Republicans after 94, when Republicans took over the House. That's the 94 set the pattern, and those two papers, I think, were ahead of their time. Mm-hmm. Doug probably is going to disagree with that.
Feel free to disagree, Doug.
They're classics.
The 94 election was a shocker because Republicans picked up 54 seats. I was sitting out here in California working for Pete Wilson, and we were obviously focused on the governor's race and what was going on in California. So we were not quite cognizant of what was happening nationally. And I remember early in the evening seeing Mario Cuomo go down in flames, and we were shocked by that. Late in the evening, the incumbent Speaker of the House, Tom Foley, loses his job. So the wave shocked us. But you look around the nation that night, Doug, and in some respects, it was a market correction. And one place where it was a market correction was in the South. Bill Clinton runs as a Southern Democrat in 1992, and that's great for him, but the party has an image problem in the old Confederacy. The Democrats lost 16 seats in the House in 1994 in the old Confederacy, the Confederate states. Do you see a similar market correction in 2018, and would that be the districts that Hillary carried, the 25 that went with her in 2016?
I do think we're seeing in the Midwest, where Trump did unexpectedly well in 2016, states like Pennsylvania, Ohio, Iowa, Wisconsin, Michigan. Those are states which are swinging back in the Democratic direction. If you look at the Senate races in all those states, the Democratic incumbents there are doing quite well. Those are states that Trump won by 1 to 10 points, and you're going to see Democrats winning by single and sometimes double-digit margins. Mm-hmm. I think overall, the process that sort of had its peak in 1994, which was that the South turned Republican right. completely, so the leftover Democratic incumbents largely disappeared. And the reverse happened in the Northeast.
Right.
We've seen the culmination of that at this point. And so anything that we're going to see going forward is going to be somewhat the places that were very red, at least, are probably going to turn more pinkish. Mm-hmm. You're seeing that in some of the battlegrounds that were in 2016. More Republican than you would have expected.
How many seats does that translate to?
Well, I promise not to tell you to the end of the podcast, but
okay.
28.
Spoiler alert. 28.
Okay, well, the show's over. I'll see you.
Bye, everybody. See you.
Thanks a lot.
So, Mo, it's easy to say that the 1994 midterm was a referendum on the first 2 years of the Clinton presidency and the failed experiment in Hillary Care. It's easy to say that the 2010 midterm was a referendum on Obamacare, the 2014 midterm, a revisiting of Obamacare. Is it as simple as saying the 28 midterm is a referendum on Donald Trump? Because everywhere I turn, this president seems determined to make this election about himself.
I think, yes, much more so than in what we call the era of incumbency and insulation in the 70s and 80s. But 94 wasn't just a referendum. 94 was, if you think back, a perfect electoral storm. One thing was, I mean, as David mentioned, as Doug mentioned, the South, this low-hanging fruit had been there for a long time, gradually getting lower and lower.
Right,
and finally,
right.
The tide was enough to take them out. Another thing that happened was, you remember the check-kiting scandal?
Yes.
There were a whole lot of people who somehow survived 92, and that came home to,
well, somehow
to get
Barbara Boxer got elected in California despite bouncing checks in the House. But
So I remember I used to lecture and just talk about how sometimes just everything comes together.
Right, you're talking 40 years of almost exclusive Democratic control.
No, that's right.
Congress.
And so add that to Clinton, et cetera. Add that to the fact that he has a 43% margin in 1992 and thinks he has a mandate to sort of turn the country back to the New Deal. I think it's clear that midterm elections now have become much more like referenda on the presidency than they were in the 60s, 70s, 80s. Mm-hmm. I think there are other things going on as well. There are demographic shifts going on. There are other things. But I think it's a reasonably accurate way to...
One more thing that was definitely going on was the party identification, which had been hugely advantaged to the Democrats, about 18 to 20 points, no matter how you counted it. That was down to now 5 or 6 points after the after 1988-90. And what had happened was a whole bunch of Southern Democrats and Democrats, not just in the South, but other places, hung on by the incumbency advantage.
Right.
And 94 was the year when that went away. Mm-hmm. And that helped make, along with the other factors. But that was a big factor in the tsunami.
But if you ask a political scientist whether a president going out and campaigning in primaries against members of his own party, whether that could work, there were presidential coattails in the midterm, we'd say you're crazy.
Right.
That's never worked out. And in fact, Trump has managed to sink a few Republicans who were critical of him. So that is something that's quite different than what we're used to.
I got asked the other day about some journalist about compare Reagan in 86 with Trump now, because Reagan. But first of all, Reagan didn't campaign so much against him. But I think one result's the same. They lost. The Republicans at that time lost control of both the House and the Senate. But the fact, I mean, they didn't have control of the House, but they lost bigger
the
majority of the House. They lost the Senate. Mm-hmm. And I think the comparison are not very good because Reagan didn't go anywhere near as far as Trump has gone.
And it's the second midterm, so it's a bit apples and oranges. Now, Reagan did get spanked in his first midterm. He lost, 26 House seats. Mm-hmm. But in 94, Doug, one thing which is interesting is if you look at the week-by-week Gallup poll, Clinton actually jumps 5 points the week before the election. It goes from 43 to 48. So, in theory, he's doing a little better than he was, but then the week after that poll, he gets knocked. So
that's a little bit reminiscent of what's happening with Trump at the moment.
Let's talk about that because
has gone up.
Let's talk because I don't know what YouGov says, but Gallup has him down 4 points the last week. He's down about 43% in the Gallup week to week.
So we're showing pretty stable. I have yet to see any movement in presidential popularity. The one thing that has moved up and down over the term is this standard poll question of, do you think the country is headed in the right direction or seriously off on the wrong track? So it has no partisan reference. Mm-hmm. So people from both sides can generally indicate that they think we're on the wrong track. But generally what you see is the members of the incumbent president's party tend to think we're headed in the right direction, and the opposition party thinks the reverse.
Right.
We've seen the low point for Trump on this was Charlottesville, and he recovered from that. But over the past few weeks, we've actually seen an increase in wrong track, and it's coming entirely from Republicans.
Have you seen any data in reaction to his reaction to the Pittsburgh shooting?
Unfortunately, we only ask this question once a week, so I won't have anything till end of the week.
Because that would seem analogous to Charlottesville, where you have the same dynamic of violence and also, again, the question of Trump and whether or not he appropriately
It's clearly not a thing that he excels at, of taking advantage of bad things happening. And
empathy is not his strong suit, not at all.
There have been some people and rabbis and others who said, "Don't come."
Yeah, but Mo, this does raise a question about what voters look at versus what we see on television. I think you've raised the point in your writing. We're in a nation of 330 million people, and you turn on Fox or MSNBC or CNN, and how many people are watching those channels a night?
We have about 235 million eligible voters, and most of these cable channels get about 1 to 1.5% of the eligible electorate watching them in any given night. Some lower, for example, CNN sort of are the real bottom feeders. They get about 0.5% of the eligible electorate every night.
Right.
I think the media. It's sort of a funny thing in a way. It's some attention. People don't pay much attention to the media, but at the same time, I think a lot of the misperception they have comes from the little attention they do pay to the media. Mm-hmm. That when you turn on a CNN or MSNBC or something like that, you tend to get extreme exemplars of the two parties, not the sort of ordinary Democrat or ordinary Republican off the street, but the media's idea of this is what a real Democrat looks like, or this is what a real Republican looks like. And so people's images of the two parties are really at odds with what the two parties actually look like when you look at the whole spectrum.
All right. So, Doug, you're looking at polls. What are voters looking at in this election? Do they really care if the chief of staff and the head of the National Security Council are in shouting arguments, or do they have something else on their
No.
mind?
Yeah, so you would think that with 4% growth, the incumbent party would be running on the economy.
Right.
Remember, it's the economy, stupid.
Right.
Well, that doesn't appear to be driving anything. Democrats, you see large fractions saying health care is important, and you see in the campaigns Democrats essentially tying themselves to Obamacare, which mm-hmm. has suddenly become a majority issue rather than a minority one.
Right. But on that question, on the very survey he's talking about, so what's the most important factor? Mm-hmm. Most important factor for Democrats is there a Democrat on the ballot? It far exceeds that. And when you ask, and so when you look for most voters who say they're really interested, mm-hmm. 30% say the most important factor. In other words, they're indicating they're going to vote Democrat. And and of women who are interested in the campaign, it's 34%. That's the most important. That's the most important factor determining their vote.
So one thing we do that's different from other pollsters is we rely heavily on past vote as a way of modeling the electorate. And the thing that is really surprising in our data is the stability of past vote. That is, 95% of the people who voted for Clinton in 2016 say they're going to vote Democratic. In the congressional elections, very small defection rates, and almost the same on the Republican side. And so we just don't see tons of switching in the data that you would expect if in the midterm there were lots of people defecting from, say, the Republicans or vice versa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, kind of the only change you get in those polls is if you ask the party identification question where you can say, do you independent, lean Republican, or lean Democrat, the number of pure independents starts to go down the closer you get to the election. And that's gone down. So now in the last poll, which is the 27th, which I just looked at before it came down, mm-hmm. it's down to 16% who now claim pure independence.
Yeah, that happens all pretty predictably around elections.
Yep.
Historically, political scientists ran election surveys every 2 or 4 years. And so we didn't have a lot of data outside of the election period. And what we've seen since we've gone to a world of almost continuous polling is that party ID around an election increases in the percent of people who say they're partisans, and then immediately after the election, it starts to fall again. So there's a cycle there.
And where does immigration fall into this? Because you have a president who is going out to rallies and he's talking about the caravan, and the president today chummed the waters by talking about doing away with birthright citizenship.
I can say that on the
it's
what's
gone,
the most
didn't
important.
It, didn't he announce that?
Yeah. What's the most important issue is it's for Republicans. 18% of Republicans say immigration is the most important issue.
Right.
Much lower for, so it's a very immigration is high for Republicans, but for the rest of our independents, not so at all, no matter how you look at independents.
It was surprising how in 2016 it wasn't very important, given all the publicity it got.
It was important to some voters in the primary.
Just the national figures on how important immigration was, it was pretty far down.
But you wouldn't
bet. I assume it's going to be up this election.
Yeah, but you're not betting that immigration is this issue going to turn the tide.
No, but I mean, Doug is talking about really marginal shifts. And so,
right. Yeah, I mean, we're seeing a few percent here. I would follow up what Mo said with if only, a half a percent of the voting public is watching CNN every night, the fraction that are at Trump rallies is, 10% of that or 5% of that.
Much less than 10%.
And so issues like immigration and the things Trump says at his rallies are actually being said to very small groups of people who are already persuaded. He's, his campaign strategy is preaching to the choir and hoping somehow that's going to bring the rest of Republicans out.
But that is immediately covered by the rest of the media.
It does get covered. Yeah. But, he feeds off of the enthusiasm of the crowds, and those people are not representative at all of marginal voters in midterm elections.
Right. So the three of you agree that this is an election, plain and simple, on Donald Trump, or would you like to say this is about Donald Trump and something else?
I was surprised by how few I've been following the YouGov weekly poll. I was surprised by the number of people who said Donald Trump was the main factor in the election of them. That's been going down. I think it's less than 10% now. Which because you would have thought, and I don't know, did you do that in 2014 or 2016 with Obama? I just don't have comparable data. But I was surprised by the fact he was so low in a percent of people saying that's the most important factor for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm a little skeptical of people's ability to say what's actually motivating them as opposed to their behavior is consistent with them voting more or less in this election the way they voted in the last.
Yeah, right.
And the reason it's going to be different from the last election where the Republicans got 2% more of the votes in the congressional elections than Democrats is that small fraction of people that are switching. Mm-hmm. But you have to resist the temptation to say, the vote is probably going to, I expect the Democrats to win 6 to 7% margin in congressional votes. So, a 4 to 5 point switch. That's coming from a very small slice of the electorate.
Right. Well, I ask about Trump because out here in California, the Democratic candidate for Governor Gavin Newsom, he spends more time talking about the president than he does his opponent. The Democratic...
Who's his opponent?
Exactly. That's the problem. The Democratic Attorney General, Javier Becerra, running for a full term. His ads feature Donald Trump. Tony Thurman, a state assemblyman who's running for superintendent of public instruction, he runs ads featuring Donald Trump. Now, you can argue this one of two ways. Either they don't have something better to talk about, they don't have a particularly big, sexy issue to run on, or they think that Donald Trump is the dog whistle that draws out votes for them.
Both.
Both.
Not mutually exclusive, yeah.
So historically, then, gentlemen, what is the parallel? Is Clinton the parallel? Is Obama? Is Richard Nixon, Franklin Roosevelt? Who's the comparable president in terms of the other side using that guy as their magnet?
I think it's... This is more like, it's going to be more like Bush in 2006, because if you think of the Republican wins in 94 and 2010, they're big.
Right.
And you heard Doug give the number of 28 in an era in which this president has never approached 50% when you average across polls. The fact that this swing is going to be 28 to 30, I would agree with him, it's somewhere between 25 and 30, 30 max. That could be a factor. So it makes it more like 2006.
But in 06, you have Bush and very unpopular wars. So you tie the two together. So it's not just the president, but it's handling particular
issues. So now you have...
This seems just largely Trump's personality, because you can't use the economy. Is there a particular issue they can assign to him? No, it's about his personality, his demeanor.
Well, it's rare to see you know, both parties going for a strategy that's relatively polarizing.
Yes.
And Trump in particular is going after issues that he knows has no appeal to Democrats, mm-hmm. And relatively little to real swing voters. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Democrats are on policies that are running on things that are intended to mobilize the base. So I think, it, you know, if Mo's right, there's this big middle out there that's ready to be captured. You would think the parties would be running towards the middle to get those voters, you know, who are between the parties, as opposed running to the edges, which is a base strategy, which is certainly, in their view, you know, the justification comes that they're going to get turnout of their base. They're not going to. That's more effective than trying to persuade.
So, Mo, you've got to bounce in a minute, so I'm going to ask you the last question.
Let me just answer that. These big middle people, they're not getting buses to the Central Valley to campaign for Democratic challengers to Republican incumbents.
Right.
The whole problem with middle people is they're not very involved in politics. We don't talk about raging moderates or knee-jerk middle-of-the-roaders. And so the problem we have now is we have these two-party bases, which are highly polarized, and they dominate the candidate selection process and the campaigns. They are the donors. They are the activists. And so we're locked in an equilibrium that I think is subpar for the country as a whole. But until somebody sort of breaks it, you know, and it's hard to see institutionally how you can break it, then we're going to continue the way we are.
So last question for you. What are you going to watch on Tuesday night, and what do you think you're going to be talking about on Wednesday morning?
Oh, boy. I'm going to wait till the results to find out what I'm going to be talking about. I'm either going to be explaining why it was inevitable what happened, or what things occurred to change the inevitability of the Democrats capturing the House.
We're much better post-fiction.
You're bringing remarks A and remarks B.
No, exactly right. Yeah, I have a whole set of, well, Kavanaugh, the caravan, et cetera. You know, I have one set of remarks. The other set of remarks, here are the models political science used, and they're right on. You know, I just sort of thought.
Well, they're wrong.
One or the other.
Yeah, right.
It'll have to be one or the other.
Exactly. But no, do you anticipate a surprise? I mean, do you? It's very easy to sit here a week out and say, okay, the House is going to go Democratic, the Senate's going to maybe go a little further Republican, Democrats going to pick up at the Senate level, and on we go. Mm-hmm. But do you really think there are going to be many plot twists?
No, I mean, but obviously there's uncertainties. I mean, we have all the results. I mean, I like Doug's data, the fact he's polling individually. You see these national figures, and you know, well, what does that mean for Iowa? What does that mean for California? You know, just sort of things that happen in California have no relevance. Well, they do have some relevance down south. But so, I mean, there's a lot of geographic variation. And given Doug is doing individual districts, when he says 30 seats, that strikes me as very
28,
likely.
28 to 30. He's very precise.
Yeah. But if they fall short, then I imagine what we talk about is how the Democrats will be tearing themselves apart. Because why did they not capture the House? Is it because they weren't progressive enough? Or is it because they were too progressive? You know, you have those battles after every disappointment.
Sort of like being a Dodgers fan right now. Mm-hmm. What did we do wrong yet again?
you know, you just came
didn't
a little
score
short.
Enough runs.
A little short, you know, just came up a little short.
But the difference there is the Dodgers fan can say, if they really take an honest look at this, we lost to a better team. Mm-hmm. But if you're a Democrat the morning after the election, you're not going to say, we lost to a better
You always lose Trump. Because the other side demonized your candidate. Your candidate was, they ran a lousy campaign. So it's never because the electorate rejected your policies. It's never the case. Yeah.
All right, Professor Fiorina is going to leave us now, and so it's a good time to switch now into polling data and what Doug sees happening on Tuesday. Thank you.
So to answer the question you asked Mo, I think there's a good chance there'll be a surprise. You know, in 2016, we were really surprised by what happened in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. In 2014, the size of the Republican victory was a surprise. And in 2006, the size of the Democratic margin was a big surprise. So you know, the predictions we make are ones of our best guess. But what we've seen in recent elections is the error in those things, one direction or the other, can be quite large.
All right, so you're saying 28 House seats at this moment. This is a week out, so now 28 House seats.
Yeah, so 28 House seats is less than what most people are predicting for the Democrats. Most people are thinking it's more in the order of 35 to 40, which would give them a 235 to 240 seats, mm-hmm. As opposed to their current 198. We have for a long time had it more close than that, and that's where we are based on our data.
Okay, so why are they falling short then?
Well, that doesn't necessarily mean they fall short. Falling short is less than 218
right,
seats.
Right, they're getting the House,
but. And it would be a complete shock to everybody if the Republicans retain the House, because if they retain the House, they're also likely to retain the Senate. Right.
They are going to.
They're probably going to retain the Senate regardless of what happens in the House. But if that happens, what's the lay of the land at that point?
Right.
The Republicans have a majority that no longer includes John McCain or Jeff Flake or any Bob Corker,
right.
Any of the people who were Trump critics. Mm-hmm. They will pass all the Trump judicial nominations, and in the House they'll have enough majority to repeal Obamacare.
28 seats would put them at about 222, 223, I think.
226.
226, okay.
Yeah, we see 226 as the likely outcome. So that would be a Democratic majority. If you get that outcome, then right. You'll have Democratic committee chairs in the House, and you will have a lot of investigations of Donald Trump, of his campaign, of his tax returns, of his business dealings.
Right.
Of his cell phone usage, you name it.
It's the I word, but not impeachment, but investigate.
But before you do that, they're coming up short. The House of Representatives, partly because of gerrymandering, I think there's 10 seats or so after as a result of the 2010,
right.
Maybe 12. But you have 65 to 75 majority-minority districts, which no one will say,
right.
Which compacts and it exacerbates the Democratic vote in those districts.
Right.
So that in 2012, when Mitt Romney lost by 5 million votes, he carried 226 congressional districts.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that built-in advantage in the House. So
right.
for the Republicans, when they had big swings, the Democrats, I don't think, can have such big swings given
right.
that geographic
which was a factor in the 94 midterm because you had
yes.
Republican governors in 90. And also, this is...
I generally agree with Dave on that, but I would say that if Democrats are in the 9-10 point margin range, then they start to pick up a lot of marginal Republican...
No, I agree
Republican
with,
seats that
right.
we don't consider yeah. marginal.
I agree with that, but the problem is that Donald Trump, among Republicans, still has an overall approval rating of above 90 points.
Right.
And when so as long as the president has that rating, and given the distribution, I think it's going to be hard. So I don't disagree with that.
Right.
And the other thing is, on the Senate side, this if you looked at the Senate and the way it's distributed this year, the vote, how many Republicans are up? How many Democrats are up in seats that states that Donald Trump carried by 10 points? This is a year that there are Republicans. If it was a normal election, seems to me you'd say they could pick up 5-6 seats.
Right.
And they're not. We're talking 2-3 seats max.
I think the ceiling is probably at 3, but there's a scenario that they could get more.
Right.
Yeah.
They could get
but
five.
There's a scenario where the Democrats
right.
can take it, too.
So let's go through the scenarios on the Senate.
Okay, so there's the first question. So the first thing I look at is Arizona and Nevada, because these are the two Republican holds.
Right. And so we polled in Arizona last weekend. We had Kyrsten Sinema up by 3 points over Martha McSally.
Right.
Close race. I think early on, before the primary, Sinema had a big lead. After the primary, the Republicans came together and each had a bunch of polling showing
she
McSally ahead.
Everything thrown at her but the kitchen sink in terms
yeah.
of negative advertising. But
right.
So you still have her up by 3, so it's a tight race. What about Nevada?
Yeah. So Nevada, we are showing Dean Heller with a slight lead. On the order of 1 to 2 points.
Okay.
Most of the polling, I'd say most of the polling there is showing Heller with a slight lead.
Mm-hmm. Which is a surprise because month or two ago, he was seen as dead man walking.
Yeah, and that makes it hard for the Democrats to take the Senate if they don't pick
up
those two.
Right. Nevada is a light blue state. Right. Voted for Hillary Clinton. This should be a Democratic
pickup. Not a state where you'd expect a huge Kavanaugh ricochet, also in the Midwest. Okay, so maybe the Democrats get one out of those two. Or maybe two, or maybe they don't get any.
We can do best case for the Democrats.
All right, so best case Democrat scenarios, they've now picked up two seats.
All right, so they need to essentially
win Nevada and Arizona. They have to now hold every seat.
And they need to hold Indiana, Missouri, and Florida. So
you have North Dakota then already.
Right. North Dakota is basically, most of the polls are showing Heidi Heitkamp down by double digits.
Right.
So most people have written that one off.
So they actually have to gain three seats then.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So find the third seat for me, Doug.
So if everything goes right for the Democrats, my sort of best case is even, absent a surprise. Mm-hmm. So a good case for the Democrats, which is really tough for them in my view, is they hold Indiana, Missouri, and Florida. We show Florida even. Other polls are showing Bill Nelson, the Democrat, up with a slight lead there.
Right.
Indiana is not a lot of polling, but it looks really close. And most of the polling, Missouri has Claire McCaskill, the Democrat, down slightly. So those
are really tight. Only 1 or 2 points.
So for the Democrats to hold those three, win Nevada and Arizona, mm-hmm. That's a really good outcome for them. That leaves them even, which means it's a 51-seat Republican majority in the Senate.
Right. Two states you didn't mention are Montana.
Right. So right now, West Virginia, Joe Manchin, the Democrat, has about a 10-point lead in most polls.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't polled that recently. Montana, we've polled. We showed John Tester up by 2 points. Other ones tend to show him by a little more than that.
Right.
So most people are assuming that Montana and West Virginia are going to...
Democratic holds.
Well, West Virginia surely will.
All right. What about Tennessee, Doug?
All right. So Tennessee was one that looked really positive for the Democrats. They have a popular, moderate former governor,
Phil Bredesen.
Right. Who was leading over the summer following the Kavanaugh vote. Or incidentally, he said he would have voted for Kavanaugh. Didn't do him any good.
Right.
Marsha Blackburn is a very Trumpy candidate.
Mm-hmm.
We have leading by 8 points.
Yeah, Blackburn up by 8 points.
Eight. And I think most people show that in a comfortable Republican lead.
Right. So you don't have a scenario for the Democrats getting back the Senate.
So it has to be a surprise.
Right. So
the surprise is... That Democrats hold the seats that they need, so they're going to lose, almost certainly are going to lose the North Dakota seat. So that puts them minus one. The possible pickups are, as we've discussed, Arizona, Nevada,
mm-hmm.
and you need Tennessee or Texas.
Right.
So we're showing Texas, Ted Cruz up by 6 points over Beto O'Rourke. Beto O'Rourke's most exciting candidate of the year, but I don't think there's been a poll that's had him in the lead.
Can you fellas talk a bit about Beto O'Rourke for a second? Because here's a good example of a race that gets a lot of attention, and Lord knows he gets a lot of buzz, and he's on HBO, and he's raised $38 million or more from outside
sources. Last quarter.
Mm-hmm. In many respects, he's a phenomenon, but we look at the polling and he trails. So explain to me, gentlemen, the disconnect between being a media sensation but actually having to collect votes.
Part of it is that the governor's race, which is, I lived in Texas for 15 years, the governor's race is usually favors Abbott. That has some effect on it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's off-year elections in Texas favor Republicans because of who turns out to vote. So it's just a tough call for him. He's made it closer than people thought.
Mm-hmm. Well, that money's not coming from Texas.
Right.
That's the world we live in where candidates raise money nationally. And to some extent, that probably hurts them in Texas.
Right.
Ted Cruz, hardly a beloved figure, is, playing the role of I'm the guy from Texas.
He's the guy from the Hamptons, yeah.
That
could be a Wednesday morning story, by the way. Beto sitting on a lot of money that could have gone elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, though I think it'll also be a story of the ineffectiveness of campaign spending in turning around fundamentals. Texas is basically, you know, a 8 to 10 point Republican point. State. And if O'Rourke brings us in at 3 or 4 points, which I think could well happen.
All right. So the Democratic path is pick up two in the near West, and then find a third seat that's an upset. Now
I've said for a while, I don't think you can make the math work on that.
So give me the numbers, Doug, on the best case Republican scenario.
Yeah. So my sort of I wrote down a best case Republicans, which is the following.
Right.
They win basically Republican states like Indiana and Missouri.
Right.
They carry a close race in Florida. Mm-hmm. They win a close race in Nevada, mm-hmm. And they win Arizona. All of those are within a few points and easily doable for Republicans.
Right.
If you do that, that puts them plus three.
Mm-hmm. 54
all right,
is
the shock on the Republican side is there's more to be had. As I said, the tester race we have at plus two.
Right.
That's not a heavily polled race. It's a definite Republican state.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another one that could be lost. And then there's New Jersey. Menendez is up by around 5 points. But, you know, it's relatively tight. You could see a shocker going the other direction. So I think plus four or even plus five is within... possibility for
which what range like 0.05
I mean what probability
0.05 if that
well I think a 5 point win is you know that's very a 5 seat gain for Republicans highly unlikely but 4 is certainly within possibility and 3 is nothing very
if you had to bet
unusual would
you
happen.
Had to bet
I bet
on 53, 47, pick up two.
I'd bet on plus one.
Plus one.
Yeah.
Historically, Republicans rarely get north of 53 or 54. I think you go back to 1929, the Herbert Hoover election, 1928. I think they came with 56 seats, maybe.
Yep. Yep.
And that's the Republican high watermark.
And incidentally, there were four less senators then.
Yes. Okay, so you have a modest Senate gain for Republicans, and you have a Democratic win in the House, but not the catastrophe that might have been predicted a few months ago. So a wave, right. But not a cataclysmic
wave. I think people would consider it a draw. Democrats got something, Republicans got a little something. When I would say, you know, a year ago, people were thinking, wow, this is going to be a catastrophe for Republicans.
Right. So sort this out for me, fellas. Just tell me on Wednesday morning when you're going through this, and let's say you're looking at a couple more Republicans in the Senate and you're looking at a Democratic House, what does this say about politics in this country?
I think people will greet it like any tie as not being very satisfying.
Right.
But what it shows is that Trump has a reservoir of support that's larger than any of us thought.
Mm-hmm. I don't know that I'd say that, given...
It's not a majority, but I'm...
Yeah, given
the idea that Trump was basically going to disintegrate...
I accept that, but I never...
I mean, if the Democrats won control of Congress, then I think Republicans would go running from Trump.
Yeah, right.
But they're not... With that outcome... They're going to continue doing what they're doing.
I never thought that it would be huge because even in 2006, which everybody talks about, it's such a big issue. I mean, Bush's popularity was in the 30s. Mm-hmm. The war in Iraq had gone bad.
Right.
And he'd proposed privatizing Social Security. And they only lost 30 seats.
Right.
So there's something in that number. So if they lose 28 seats, why is 2006... such a big time election and 2018 not. So that, now I forget how the press interprets it.
Right.
The first thing I'd want to think about is that's not too bad if you're a Democrat to come within 2 seats of where you were in 2006, mm-hmm. which was a big deal then.
Right.
And on the Senate side, the odds of them ever doing very well, taking over the Senate, well, it had to have been a huge wave. It had to be like 2010. or 1994. And even in so 1994, and even in 2010 with the huge House win, they still didn't take the Senate. Right. So I would think if the Democrats take over, rational Democrats would have to be happy with that. You're going to do as Doug said. You're going to have investigations. Now their problem at that point will be, can they keep the crazies from trying to impeach the president, which wouldn't help much. My guess is they'd probably be able to do that. So then you're going to have these investigations, Doug Tarr. It means the president's not going to get his stuff through. He'll get his judges through on the court side, but they're not going to repeal the Affordable Care Act. There's going to be no policy possible. And a lot of people don't mind gridlock.
Yeah, I think in terms of setting the stage for 2020, it's pretty dangerous for Democrats to control both houses of Congress.
Right.
If they can control the House, they can keep from getting railroaded the way they were in the first 2 years of the Trump administration.
I agree with
that. But they aren't going to have to take responsibility for anything that goes bad.
So I turn to the Rolling Stones and the song that Donald Trump plays at his rallies. You can't always get what you want, but you find sometimes you get what you need. And maybe this is an election, gentlemen, where both parties, in some regards, get what they need in Congress. The Democrats get control of the House. So, yes, they can now investigate this guy and have administrative members do the perp walk up to Capitol Hill and just have a grand old time investigating and maybe even impeachment if they want to go that road. The Republicans keep the Senate, which means one thing. They get to keep minting judges for the next 2 years. Right. So they both get their share of the pie.
Okay, I've waited a long time. I got a question for you.
Yes.
What's happening in California in the competitive House races?
That's a good question. I was hoping Doug had data on that. So you're looking at 6 or 7. So this is the question about how high this goes to the 9-point question or not. So right now there are about 6 or 7 seats in California that are very much in play, some more so than others. I think I would take away almost every seat in Southern California right now. Maybe the one currently held by Duncan Hunter Jr., they might hold on to that, which is ironically, he's probably the least deserving guy to be sent back to Congress.
Right.
Rohrabacher maybe slips back in for another term, but that's a tough race for him. You could, the map of California the morning after the election could be fascinating, guys, in that it's a question of how high you have to go in the state to find a red congressional district. The bottom third of the state could be all blue.
Yeah, so... The strategy Trump's been employing nationally, which is this polarization strategy going to the base, that hurts him in California.
Right.
And so I think we're probably likely to see a little bit of surprises on the marginal seats, like 48 and 49.
Right.
Both
so,
go Democrat.
You know, we talked earlier about Trump and Trump being, you know, on the receiving end of Democratic brickbats out here. But you look at polling data in California, and it's so unusual. We did a poll with YouGov for the Bill Lane Center, and well, to give away a few numbers here, Donald Trump is just an albatross for Republicans here. Okay. His disapproval is 60%. This is a guy who ran in 2016, did the worst in the state since Alf Landon in 1936. He has a 60% disapproval here. 5 out of 8 voters in that poll do not want him to seek a second term, and he is just an enormous liability for a Republican candidate. So you mentioned John Cox running for governor. The man just has to tap dance around Trump in just painful ways. So the president's a problem out here, more so than H.W. Bush was. And that's a problem for these guys, plain and simple. So I think, Dave, about the House, I think Republicans could lose 5 or 6 seats out here quite easily. I just wrote a piece for Real Clear Politics about how California is sort of a newfound national clout, if you will, in terms of things happening in California that suddenly are relevant. The morning after the election, Kamala Harris is going to be all over the news, you know, preparing to run for president. Eric Garcetti, the mayor of Los Angeles, Gavin Newsom, expected to be the new governor. He won't run for president, I think, but still he's going to be in the conversation. Don't forget Tom Steyer, the billionaire hedge fund fellow, Dave's buddy, and that attorney down in Newport Beach, Michael Avenatti. These are all people from California who want to have a say in matters. But you look at the Democratic House lineup. If it's 226 seats, you could have 44 or 45 of those seats coming from California. That's 1/5 of the delegation. And this is a state that is it's 55 electoral votes. So what is that? It's what, 1/9 of the Electoral College? Yeah. So California plays an outsized role in the Democratic existence in the House.
Yeah, and in midterms, the supermajorities for Democrats in California actually translates into right. something useful, whereas in presidential elections, it's pure wasted votes.
Yeah, it is. So it's very funny. The Cleveland Browns fired their coach the other day. Not funny, but Mr. Jackson got fired, Hugh Jackson. But his record was something like 3-36-1 in Cleveland. He had to go 11-5 for like 5 years.
He had
Two wins this year, which was his high watermark. So they fire him with a 3-36-1 record. If you look at the California Republican Party going back to 2006 and look at statewide races, so this is state constitutional and Senate and presidential, it's a record of 2 wins and 29 losses. And they're about to go over. They're about to go over on Tuesday night. It's not a lot that matter, actually. Yeah. But it's remarkable futility, and they may be one or two non-Democrats who actually win in California on Tuesday night. One could be the new insurance commissioner, Steve Poizner, who ran as a Republican in 2006.
Yep.
And then Marshall Tuck, who was an independent from down in Los Angeles, running for a superintendent of public instruction. So Republican is a toxic word out here.
Yeah,
and it's a question for the party. Is it a problem with messengers? Because going back to 2002 with Bill Simon moving forward, Republicans have been going with first-time California candidates running for governor. That's starting a rookie quarterback and expecting to win the Super Bowl. It's hard. Or is it the message? If you look again at that Lane Center poll, which we have coming out this week, and look at what California voters said are the most important issues, yes, taxation is on there, and yes, John Cox is talking about Proposition 6 and repealing the increase in the gas tax, but he's not really getting into immigration, which is an important issue. He's not getting into health care, which is an important issue. He's not getting into the environment. Instead, he is basing this on a gasoline tax and long lines at the Division of Motor Vehicles. And I've been in enough campaigns to know that's just not a viable strategy.
It was the case several years ago. I haven't seen any polling recently, but a huge majority of Republicans in California were pro-choice. But the platform, because of the activists versus that, which is Mo's point about activists versus the center, it's hard to be a moderate Republican and want to spend 6 days in Sacramento fighting over the platform.
Yeah.
So that and several other issues, I agree, that's a problem for them.
Well, the Republicans are not going to win in California by appealing to national issues.
Right.
The places where you see minority party governors, which you do see in places like Massachusetts,
Maryland.
Right. Where you get Republican governors is on a good government corruption platform.
They're not pro-life. They're pro-choice.
You stay off the national.
You stay
exactly. Larry Hogan and Charlie Baker, right?
And
yes,
and Baker's the most popular governor in America, I think.
Yep.
And you know, that's basically how we got Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Right.
Yep.
We wouldn't have gotten Schwarzenegger if he had to go through a Republican primary.
Exactly.
I disagree. He might have actually made it through the primary. He would have just spent enough and worn them down, I think. But the problem is Arnold would have had to completely redesign and cater himself to a more conservative crowd. So he probably would have said things on immigration he did not want to.
So, I mean, I think Republican strategy in California has got to wait for the Democrats to shoot themselves in the foot.
That's the answer, plain and simple. So you have to hope that the new governor, who is not to be confused with Jerry Brown, he is 29 years younger and brings a lot of different sensibilities to the table from Brown. You might, if you're a Republican, you have to hope that he and the legislature just overplays its hands on taxes and just a lot of social engineering, and voters, you react to that strongly. But you have to do something along the lines of the recall, where you have problems bred by government, rolling blackouts, an increase in the vehicle license fee, that, pardon my language, just piss people off.
Yep.
There is a recall effort that's going to be mounted against the Attorney General next year, Javier Becerra. It's being mounted by the Proposition 6 campaign, claiming that Becerra, as the Attorney General, did a misleading title and summary on Prop 6. Well, that's not the same as Arnold going out in 2003 and dropping wrecking balls on cars and connecting with people that way. So you need something just to hit people out of the blue in California. But final question here, Doug. So take me quickly through election night. You're going to be at CBS, right?
Right.
CBS and YouGov partner. What is being done differently in 2018 that from 2016 so we don't get the great surprise?
So there'll be an exit poll. Fox has dropped out of the exit poll consortium, so they will have something different than what the other networks have.
So they're going to have their own versus what you guys have?
They are doing a combination of online polls and statistical models.
Is this your pal Darren Shaw?
Yes.
Okay.
The New York Times will have their needle, which will have, you know, probabilities.
This is one that started with Hillary at 90 and
right.
just went yeah. south as the night went on. Right?
Yeah. So I don't know exactly which races they're going to have that for overall control, but mm-hmm. That'll be a fun thing for people to watch. Mm-hmm. We at CBS have been collecting some different sorts of data to improve our ability to call House races. The exit poll is actually not useful for calling the House. Mm-hmm. The exit poll is largely going to be used for Senate races and secondarily for a couple interesting gubernatorial races. Mm-hmm. I think in terms of a viewing guide, if you're in California, the first polls close at 6 p.m. On the East Coast in Kentucky and parts of Indiana. Right. There's a very interesting race in Kentucky's 5th congressional district. Which is one of the tightest races in the country. They count pretty fast, and we'll have an idea of what's happening there. By the time California finishes voting, we're going to have a pretty good idea whether there's a big surprise or not.
You would bounce from Kentucky to where, Florida, Georgia?
Yeah, so Florida closes at 8, I believe, and I think Georgia at 7.
Florida has 2 zones, right?
Yeah, but yeah. There's a small part of Florida in the panhandle.
Right.
They will be reporting exit poll data in Florida before the panhandle closes.
And that'll be the very fascinating gubernatorial race with Mr. Gillum, to see if that happens.
Both the Georgia and Florida gubernatorial races, which usually people snooze through them, those are fascinating races. You've got black candidates running in red to pink southern states.
Right.
That would be quite I didn't think they were going to be viable, and both have run races where Gillum is actually up and Stacey Abrams in Georgia is close.
Yeah, and there could be a runoff in Georgia, which means that your work won't be done for the year.
Right. Georgia is a state where you have to get 50% of the vote, otherwise they have a runoff.
Okay, then quickly in the Midwest, what are you looking at in the Midwest? Are you going to Iowa or what state
are
you focused
on? So the first one I would watch is Indiana.
Indiana.
Joe Donnelly's a moderate Democrat. And Indiana is a pretty red state.
Right.
So for Democrats to have any chance at getting a majority in the Senate, they need Indiana. Mm-hmm. Indiana closes early, counts moderately quickly.
That's on the Trump last week circuit. He's gonna do an appearance there.
Yeah, and then Missouri, the McCaskill race is likely to be really close.
Right.
I suppose a shocker would be North Dakota coming at that point, but I think that one's probably a foregone conclusion.
Then we're in the Mountain Time Zone, so now you're looking at Arizona and Nevada.
Right.
And then on the West Coast, you're going to be, in Southern California in the House races?
The place to watch on the West Coast is the California congressional races.
There are
as many as 10 of those that could be very close.
Okay. And Dave Brady, where are you going to be on election night?
I will be teaching a class on economic growth and development at New York University. And Doug Rivers, my friend Doug Rivers will be texting me the results.
Why don't you invite Brady over to CBS? What's the worst that could happen?
They don't want me there. No, the class.
There's not a lot of room in the studio.
Class, there's not room. They did take me up once. The class gets over at 9, and those guys are there till 2 or 3 in the morning.
Okay.
They're not even available for a drink at 2.
Yeah.
But I'm the one not available then.
Well, we ran a little long on this, but I really enjoyed this talk, guys, and look forward to seeing what comes true next week.
Aren't we all?
Okay. Have a good trip.
Well, just remember that how we did in 2016, the three of us.
We're trying to forget that.
We nailed it, right?
Guys, well, you don't want to leave humility behind.
Guys, thanks very much for the conversation.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. If you wouldn't mind, please spread the word and get your friends to have a listen. The Hoover Institution is online at www.hoover.org. And while you're there, sign up for Hoover's Daily Report, which delivers the best work of David Brady, Mo Fiorina, and Doug Rivers and their Hoover colleagues to your inbox every weekday. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst, that's @HooverInst. Doug Rivers, by the way, is the chief pollster for YouGov, and the Twitter handle for YouGov, Doug, is what? @YouGov, right? @YOUGOV?
@YouGovUS. @YouGovUS. Unless you want a lot of British results.
So check that out for our election data as well. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalum. We'll be back soon with another broadcast of Area 45. Until then, take care. Thanks for listening.
For more podcasts from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org or Hoover's channels on all major podcast platforms, including Apple, Google, Podbean, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Spotify. I'm Chris Dauer for the Hoover Institution. Thanks for listening.